The Interrupted Journey, Two Lost Towers Aboard a Flying Saucer. Introduction. On December 14, 1963, Mr. Barney Hill presented himself at my office to keep his appointment for a consultation. It was like any other day. The appointment had been made in advance, and Mr. Hill had been referred for the consultation by another psychiatrist. At the time I knew nothing of Mr. Hill's problems, but when he introduced his wife, who is white, I wondered, fleetingly, if their interracial marriage might be involved in Mr. Hill's disturbance. At his request I saw the couple together and soon realized that both needed help. A month after the sighting, the Hills had been interviewed by Walter Webb, a lecturer at Boston's Hayden Planetarium and a scientific advisor to the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. With a copy of Mr. Webb's report to NICAP as a basis, Mr. and Mrs. Hill unfolded the story which follows in Mr. Fuller's book. At the time there was no indication that either the interracial marriage or the UFO experience bore more than a tangential relationship to the central problems which Mr. and Mrs. Hill presented: crippling anxiety, manifested by him in fairly open fashion and by Mrs. Hill more in the form of repetitive nightmarish dreams. Aside from its topical interest, the UFO experience was important because it presented for both Mr. and Mrs. Hill the focal point of the anxiety which had apparently impeded the psychiatric treatment Mr. Hill had been undergoing for some time. This point appeared to be a period of time in the course of their trip home from Canada in September 1961. They were constantly haunted by a nagging anxiety centering around this period of several hours, a feeling that something had occurred, but what? A treatment program was outlined for the Hills, and it was decided first to try to unlock the door to the hidden room, the uneasy air, and that for this aspect of therapy, hypnosis would be used. Plans were made to begin treatment after the coming Christmas holidays, the first treatment session being set for January 4, 1964. Apart from the unique quality engendered by the UFO story, treatment proceeded apace as might be expected with two very anxious and co-operative patients, and continued regularly until terminated at the end of June, 1964. During this time there was no portent of the unfolding drama which began on December 1, 1963, which was to extend back in time for 2 years and to extend forward to this moment exactly 2.5 years later, when I would be writing an introduction to the book which was to revive the whole drama, an unfolding of events of which I had had no hint during the whole period of treatment. It was a drama which culminated in Mr. Fuller's book and the my introduction, which is rather unique in being an apologia for my presence on stage as a reluctant member of the dramatis personae. The formal treatment program was terminated on June 27, 1964. And from then until late summer of 1965 the Hills and I maintained contact through reports of their progress by visits and telephone calls. I had no indication of the developing storm until the late summer of 1965, when I received a telephone call from a newspaper reporter who appeared to be aware of the Hill story, their treatment, and my part in it, including the use of hypnosis. He requested an interview with me, which I refused, informing him that one would not discuss the Hills' case without their written consent, and that even with their written permission any discussion would have to depend on my judgment of its potential effect on their emotional health. A month or two later Mr. Hill, in considerable distress, called to say that the reporter had approached them for an interview which they had refused. He, the reporter, claimed to have data on the case which he would publish without an interview with them if they refused to comply. It appeared to me that there was nothing that could be done on this basis. The question of giving an interview would be a matter for themselves to decide, perhaps with legal advice. While I was attending professional meetings in Washington during the week of October 25, 1965, my colleague called that all hell had broken loose. The rework calls from Mr. Hill and calls from a great many strangers. Allel seemed to be connected with the appearance of a series of articles in a Boston newspaper. These were written by the reporter to T.I., whom I had refused the interview and, apparently, without permission from Mr. and Mrs. Hill. My associates and our office staff did the best they could with the calls pending my return. On my return, Mr. Hill telephoned and expressed their great distress over this series of articles which I had not yet seen. He felt that they distorted the truth and considered them a violation of his right of privacy. He wanted my advice, and I suggested that he seek legal advice. From Mr. Hill I also learned that I had been named in the articles, which explained the large number of calls coming to my office. The nature of these calls gave me a fairly good clue to the way the articles were being interpreted by the general public. The callers could be classified into four major groups. 1. THEDS PERI NG, these were people who were apparently emotionally or mentally ill and who saw in hypnosis, as it was presented by the reporter, the magical solution to their problems. 2. THE MYSTICS, people who were interested in clairvoyance, extrasensory perception, astrology and other related phenomena. Many of this group saw in the experience and the hypnosis support of their own ideas and beliefs. 3. THEFLI travelers, these were the self-appointed interviewers who knew the answers to the mysteries of life and saw in the Hill's experience and the hypnosis confirmation of their beliefs. Most of them seemed to be motivated by the wish to bring themselves to my attention as mutual supporters, perhaps for their gain. 4. THE sympathizers, a number of callers expressed sympathy for my persecution by the writer, who mentioned me either as a Boston or Back Bay psychiatrist, or by name, in all but one of the articles. The use of my name was quite subtle, and I was regularly credited with refusing to violate the doctor-patient relationship by discussing the case. Quite subtly, however, the total impression created in the articles was that some of the fantastic statements which were made came from revelations made under hypnosis, and in some way from me, hence my many phone calls and letters from the public. After consultation with friends and their counsel, the Hills decided that the best way to handle the newspaper articles and any further forays into this field would be to publish the truth. At the time, Mr. John Fuller had been investigating UFO phenomena in the New Hampshire area and was working on a book about incidents in the Exeter area. The Hills discussed the matter with me and asked me to make available to Mr. Fuller my RIGVI, ORDS, chiefly the tape recordings of their treatment, so that they could present an authentic version of the true story as they had experienced it. Public interest, rather than abating, had been increasing, and there was danger that other stories might be published which would increase their distress. For therapeutic purposes, all of the treatment under hypnosis had been recorded verbatim on a tape recorder. It was inevitable, I suppose, that Mr. Fuller would want to have this verbatim and incontestable material, and the Hills' request was understandable. The physician's records are his property, but the contents of these records should be available in the interest of his patients. In this sense, they are also property of the patients. I decided ultimately that the paramount issue, the emotional health of Mr. and Mrs. Hill, would best be served by releasing the recordings if I could be assured that they would be used honestly, and not detrimentally to them. It appeared that both Mr. Fuller and I had had the same idea and had checked each other's biographies in WHO's WHO and THE East to our mutual satisfaction. Conferences with Mr. Fuller and the Hills ensued, and it was agreed that I would have the right to pass on all medical data in the book to prevent, as much as possible, the creation of false impressions and conclusions. It was also agreed that no information of a personal and intimate nature would be revealed if it was not relevant to the UFO experience and the period of amnesia. Mr. Fuller hoped to revivify the experiences and the emotional reactions which were so well expressed in the tape recordings, a difficult task indeed. The decision to release the recordings created a corollary problem for me, the matter of my professional anonymity, one of the canons of our profession. In this I was already the victim of the newspaper articles in which I was mentioned without my consent. By now this was no longer a local matter involving only the city of Boston. I received calls and letters from other cities, and when I received a request for information from as far west as Wisconsin, it was obvious I no longer possessed any anonymity, and the disclosure of my participation could cause me to be identified with certain statements and conclusions by the reporter about the two ills ex-princess, with which I strongly disagree. The mystique of hypnosis and my position as the mystical master by the simple act of association with the statements in the story seem to give them the quality of an authenticity quite at variance with the facts. Though R.H. have confined my active participation in this book to editorial supervision of medical statements, I feel that I should make clear the status of hypnosis because of public misconceptions which often envelop hypnosis with an arcane charisma, and the practitioner with the robe of Merlin. Hypnosis is a useful procedure in psychiatry to direct concentrated attention on some particular point in the course of the whole therapeutic procedure. In cases like the Hills, it can be the key to the locked room, the amnesic period. Under hypnosis, experiences buried in amnesia may be recalled in a much shorter time than in the normal course of the psychotherapeutic process. Nevertheless, there is little produced under or by hypnosis that is not possible without. The charisma of hypnosis has tended to foster the belief that hypnosis is the magical and royal road to truth. In one sense this is so, but it must be understood that hypnosis is a pathway to the truth as it is felt and understood by the patient. The truth is what he believes to be the truth, and this may or may not be consonant with the ultimate non-personal truth. Most frequently it is. In the exercise of my editorial rights over Mr. Fuller's book, I have confined myself as strictly as possible to the medical data, my observations and records. I have tried to avoid loose speculation insofar as my own data is concerned without inhibiting Mr. Fuller's free expression of his own reasoning and conclusions as long as my data was not distorted. To me, the story is the partial documentation of fascinating human experience in an unusual setting connected with what are popularly called unidentified flying objects. Their existence, the UFOs, as concrete objects is of less concern to me than the experience of these two people showing the cumulative impact of past experiences and fantasies on their present experiences and responses. To Mr. Fuller, the former is understandably of greater concern. It follows that his reasoning and speculations are his own, based on his evaluation of my data, the Hills' statements, his past experience and his present convictions. I have no doubt given him sleepless nights and many moments of despair. I am sure there have been times when he felt I was taking the life of his child, but he has always taken my criticism with good grace and has managed to remove the objectionable or restore the missing in a manner which would be acceptable to me, so that even I, who have lived through much of it, find the book good reading indeed. Benjamin Simon, June 14, 1966. 9, M.D., Foreword. I stumbled on the story of Barney and Betty. She rarely uses Eunice, her formal name, Hill, entirely by accident, or rather by a series of accidents. I knew little or nothing about the subject of unidentified flying objects until I explored a rather startling case involving the police department of Exeter, New Hampshire, and wrote a short piece about it in the Tradewinds column in the Saturday Reverend U. As a result of this piece, I went on to write a more extensive article on the case for Look, which later became the book Incident at Exeter. In the process of doing the research in southern New Hampshire for all this, I spoke to Conrad Quimby, editor and publisher of the Derry, New Hampshire, News, who mentioned the fact that an extremely intelligent and reliable couple he knew had encountered a UFO in the White Mountains back in 1961. The incident had caused them considerable emotional strain. He further said that they had been very reluctant to discuss their case except with a few close friends because they did not want to be considered eccentric, and the subject was so controversial that they thought it might interfere with their dedicated work in the civil rights movement. At the time Mr. Quimby mentioned this to me, I was concentrating only on the rash of sightings made in the summer of 1965, still continuing as this is written. Since I found over 60 persons in the area who had seen UFOs at treetop level within the current year, some of these people experiencing the objects coming directly over their cars not more than 20 or 30 feet in altitude, I felt that it would be difficult to document the current cases. I made a brief note about Barney and Betty 11, Hill, realizing that I would probably not need to interview them. If they were reluctant to discuss their case publicly, I did not want to persuade them against their judgment in a matter of personal choice. My research in the Exeter area extended for several weeks. I had at first suspected that their UFO story could be explained by careful, painstaking research in a single area, and that a rational answer should turn up. It didn't. The more the evidence accumulated, the more it became impossible to maintain my skepticism. Police, Air Force pilots and radar men, Navy personnel and Coast Guardsmen all confirmed the incredible reports that dozens of reliable and competent citizens in the area were giving me in grueling cross-examinations. I took advantage of the Exeter Police Station as a base from which to conduct the research, since current reports of the phenomenon gravitated there. Toward the end of my research period, a message was left at the police station that Mr. and Mrs. Hill would appreciate it if I'd call them in nearby Portsmouth. As a social worker for the state of New Hampshire, Mrs. Hill made regular visits to the police station to check on various welfare cases in which the police might be involved. The Hills had indicated to the desk officer that they might be able to supply me with some helpful information on their UFO research. Later that day, I talked with Mrs. Hill, who felt that the subject was becoming important and needed exploration by responsible research. She gave me the names of some people in the area who had come to her with reports of seeing the objects. She felt they were of unimpeachable character and were, in her estimation, accurate observers. But she said nothing whatever about her own case. It was obvious to me that she was reluctant to discuss it, and knowing her attitude from Conrad Quimby, I did not press the subject. Several weeks later, a series of articles broke in a Boston newspaper, telling without the full background material the story of Barney and Betty Hill and how, while under hypnosis by a Boston psychiatrist, they had told of being abducted aboard a UFO, given a physical examination, and released with the assurance that they would not be harmed one ed. The Itills said the story had been written without their permission, or without their being interviewed by the reporter involved, and they were extremely upset about it. They had known nothing about the forthcoming story when I had talked with Mrs. Hill on the phone. The possibility of privacy was destroyed by the articles, and the Hills felt that as long as their story had been released, the facts of the case should be carefully presented. The Hills had sat on this story for nearly 5 years. They were not seeking publicity. The Hills asked me if I were interested in documenting the story, with their cooperation. I agreed that it would be a project of overwhelming public interest. Instead of writing one book, I have ended up by doing two. The feelings of the Hills themselves can best be explained by the letter Betty Hill wrote to her mother regarding the release of this book. "Dear Mother, Barney and I are writing to you to let you know that we have finally reached a decision in regards to our UFO experience. As you know, from the very beginning of our experience, we questioned our position and responsibility. In the beginning, we felt that this was our own personal experience, and believed that there really was not any great public interest. A few people who had witnessed UFOs were interested in the subject, but we believed that the overall picture was one of boredom, disbelief, and apathy. We personally became interested in obtaining more information in our seeking of answers to so many questions. And we still are seeking. In the last few weeks, we have been questioning this attitude of our personal right to privacy. I really think our feelings began to change following the publication in the article you read in the newspaper about us. When the reporter contacted us for an interview, prior to the release of his story, we refused to meet him or discuss our experience with him. We asked him not to release the story. We were fearful, for we believed that we right to ask that publication be stopped, for he felt that our experience was of great public interest. To our amazement, public reaction was not what we expected. Fortunately for us, numerous sightings occurred in our local area, well-documented reports which were well-publicized. In the midst of these, the newspaper story was released. Public reaction was instantaneous. Everyone wanted to know about our experience. We received telephone calls from Europe, Canada, and all over the United States. We were contacted by TV and radio stations, newspaper reporters visited, and letters from everywhere, from people of all kinds of backgrounds, From all age groups of the printed letters of small children to the spidery writing of an elderly person. Students wrote wanting to know more, asking advice on books to read, thinking about space travel and life on other planets. One boy wrote a thank you note to us saying that he had read the books we suggested and used the information in a science fair project, winning a prize. When we visited a school in connection with our work, teachers asked 13 would face scorn, ridicule, and disbelief. The reporter said that we had no us to speak briefly to the class. High school teachers asked us to discuss UFOs in their assemblies. People came to us and told us of their own experiences with UFOs. They asked advice. One woman called to say a UFO was flying around the backfield and her husband wanted to go out to it. Did we think he should do this? Desperately to believe. How was the trip? Did we go to Venus and Mars? Did they try to give us a miraculous cure for cancer, or heart disease, etc.? Were they going to save us from ourselves and solve our unanswerable problems for us? Did we believe that this signified the second coming of Christ? As well as the question, were we sober? We feel that first of all, we must clarify what actually happened and set the record straight. This would necessarily include the information obtained while under treatment by Dr. Simon. We have made arrangements with the author, John G. Fuller, to write the book for us. Since Mr. Fuller felt that the material on the tape recordings was necessary for an adequate presentation, we asked Dr. Simon to make his records available to him. We hope the publication of this book will enable the reader to judge for himself and to decide if this is illusion, hallucination, dream, or reality. Love, Betty and Barney. Then the rumors started. Fantastic fantasies that people wanted so. I can only add that working with the Hills and Dr. Simon has been a rewarding and educational experience. All three have a passion for accuracy and a profound respect for understatement and documentation. If this comes through in the book, I will have accomplished my objective. One final note. Most of the dialogue taking place between the Hills during the incident is taken directly from the recordings of their hypnosis sessions with Dr. Simon. John G. Fuller, July, 1966, Poe Wright, Connecticut, Xit. The Interrupted Journey, Two Lost Towers Aboard a Flying Saucer, I, Chapter 1. September. I and the White Mountains. Is the cruelest month. The gaunt hotels, vestiges of Victorian tradition, are shuttered, or getting ready to be. Motels and overnight cabins flash their neon vacancy signs for only a few fitful hours before their owners give up and retire early. The New Hampshire ski slopes are barren of snow and skiers, the trails appearing as great, brownish gashes beside the silent tramways and chairlifts. The Labor Day exodus has swept most of the roads clear of traffic. Very few vacation trailers and roof-laden station wagons straggle toward Boston or the New York thruways. Winter is already here on the chilled and ominous slopes of Mount Washington, its summit weather station clocking the highest wind velocities ever recorded on any mountaintop in the world. Bears and red foxes roam freely. In a few weeks, hunters in scarlet or luminous orange jackets will be on the trails, intent on deer or ruffed grouse, or anything legal in sight. The skiers follow later, their minds on powder snow and hot butter drum, as they bring back the gay holiday mood of summer. Once again the White Mountains will take on a new life. It was in the doleful mid-September period of 1961, September 19th, to be exact, that Barney Hill and his wife Betty began their drive from the Canadian border down US 3, through the White Mountains, on their way home to Portsmouth. It was to be a night drive, brought on by a sense of urgency. The radio of their 1957 Chevrolet Bel Air hardtop made it clear that a hurricane coming up the coast might cut in toward New Hampshire, an event that in previous years had uprooted 3 trees and spilled high-tension wires across the roads. They had failed to bring along enough cash to cover all the extras of their holiday trip, and their funds had dwindled sharply as they had driven leisurely up to Niagara Falls, then circled back through Montreal toward home. They had cleared through the U.S. Canadian Custom House at about 9 that evening, winding along the lonely ceiling of Mont's Northeast Kingdom, a section of the state that is said to have threatened to secede not only from Vermont, but from the United States as well. The traffic was sparse, few other cars appeared on the road before the hills approached the welcome lights of Colebrook a half an hour later, an ancient New Hampshire settlement founded in 1770, lying in the shadow of Mount Monadnock, just across the river from Vermont. The lights of the village, though a relief from the endless turns of the narrow two-way road they had been traveling, were few. A forlorn glow came from the windows of a single restaurant, and realizing that this might be the last chance for any bracing refreshment for the rest of the trip, they decided to turn back even though they had driven past it. The restaurant was nearly deserted. A few teenagers gathered in a far corner. Only one woman, the waitress, in the quiet restaurant seemed to show any reaction at all to the fact that Betty and Barney Hills was a mixed marriage. Barney, a strikingly handsome descendant of a proud Ethiopian freeman whose great-grandmother was born during slavery, but raised in the house of the plantation owner because she was his own daughter, Betty, whose family bought three tracts of land in York, Maine, in 1637, only to have one member cut down by Indians. Regardless of what attention their mixed marriage drew in public places, they were no longer self-conscious about it. Their first attraction to each other, one that still remained, was of intellect and mutual interests. Together, they stumped the state of New Hampshire speaking for the cause of civil rights. Barney, former political action and now legal redress chairman of the Portsmouth NAACP, was also a member of the Estate Advisory Board of the United States Civil Rights Commission and the Board of Directors of the Rockingham County Poverty Program. Both he and his wife are proud to display the award he received from Sergeant Shriver for his work. Betty, a social worker for the state of New Hampshire, continues after hours with her job as Assistant Secretary and Community Coordinator for the NAACP, and as United Nations Envoy for the Unitarian Universalist Church to which they belong in Portsmouth. Lut what was to happen to them this night of September 19, 1961, for, have nothing whatever to do with their successful mixed marriage, or their happen as they sat at the paneled restaurant counter in Colebrook, _dedication to social progress. Nor was there any hint of what was to Barney unceremoniously eating a hamburger, Betty a piece of chocolate layer cake. They didn't linger too long at the counter, just long enough for a cigarette and a cup of black coffee before they continued down US 3 toward home. The distance from Colebrook to Portsmouth is 170 miles, with US 3 remarkably smooth and navigable in the face of the deep mountain gorges it must negotiate. Further south, below Plymouth, nearly 30 miles of four-lane highway more than that now invite safe speeds up to 65 miles an hour. For the other roads, Barney Hill liked to drive between 50 and 55, even if this should be a shade above the limit. The clock over the restroom in the Colebrook restaurant read 10:05 when they left that night. It looks, Barney had said to Betty as they got in their car, like we should be home by 2:30 in the morning or 3:00 at the latest. Betty agreed. She had confidence in Barney's driving, even though she sometimes goaded him for pushing too fast. It was a bright, clear night with an almost full moon. The stars were brilliant, as they always are in the New Hampshire mountains on a cloudless night, when starshine seems to illuminate the tops of the peaks with a strange incandescence. The car was running smoothly through the night air, the road winding effortlessly along the fiat ground of the uppermost Connecticut River Valley, an ancient Indian and lumbering country, rich in history and legend. The 30 miles south to Northumberland, where Rogers Rangers made their rendezvous after the sack of St. Francis, passed quickly. Betty, an inveterate sightseer, enjoyed the brilliance of the moon reflecting on the valley and the mountains in the distance, both in New Hampshire to the east and over the river to Vermont in the west. Delcy, the hill's scrappy little dachshund, was at peace on the floor by the front seat at Betty's feet. Through Lancaster, a village with a wide main street and fine old pre-revolutionary houses all dark now on this September night. 3 continues south as the Connecticut River swings westward to widen New Hampshire's territory and narrow Vermont's.